Again, it will be like a man going on a journey who called his servants and entrusted his wealth to them. To one he gave 5 bags of gold, to another 2 bags, and to another 1 bag, each according to his ability. Then he went on his journey. The man who had received 5 bags of gold went at once and put his money to work and gained 5 bags more. So also the one with 2 bags of gold gained 2 more. But the man who had received 1 bag went off, dug a hole in the ground, and hid his master's money. After a long time, the master of those servants returned and settled accounts with them. The man who had received 5 bags of gold brought the other 5. "Master," he said, "you entrusted me with 5 bags of gold. See, I have gained 5 more. His master replied, "Well done, good and faithful servant. You've been faithful with a few things. I will put you in charge of many things. Come and share your master's happiness." The man with 2 bags of gold also came. "Master," he said, "you entrusted me with 2 bags of gold. See, I have gained 2 more. His master replied, "Well done, good and faithful servant. You have been faithful with a few things. I will put you in charge of many things. Come and share your master's happiness." Then the man who had received 1 bag of gold came. "Master," he said, "I knew that you are a hard man, harvesting where you have not sown and gathering where you have not scattered seed. So I was afraid and went out and hid your gold in the ground. See, here is what belongs to you." His master replied, "You wicked, lazy servant. So you knew that I harvest where I have not sown and gather where I have not scattered seed. Well then, you should have put the money on deposit with the bankers so that when I returned, I would have received it back with interest. So take the bag of gold from him and give it to the one who has 10 bags. For whoever has will be given more, and they will have an abundance. Whoever does not have, even what they have will be taken from them. And throw that worthless servant outside into the darkness, where there will be weeping and gnashing of teeth."
Thank you for that reading, and thank you, Simon. I'm actually staying with Simon. I've known from time at St. Barnabas in Broadway when we both had hair, and it was fantastic. Look at us now, though, brother. But it's funny, I was staying there last night, and I was just in the room I'm staying in, and I noticed on the wall one of the diplomas there, and so I should be addressing you as Dr. Spears. I didn't know that. He has a PhD. And it just so happens, I was a while ago, I shared this with somebody during the break, I went to a petrol station back before we had phones, and I left my wallet at home, and it's not because I'm Scottish background and a bit frugal with the money, but I actually genuinely forgot. So I had to fill out this form, and I was in academics at the time, and so I filled out this form, and it said title, and just by default I was in academics, I hit doctor. And the guy said to me, "Are you a doctor?" And I said, "Well, I got a PhD, but it's a research PhD. And the guy looked at me and he says, "What's your area of specialty?" I said, "Greek New Testament." And he looked at me and he said, "I've got this twitch in my eye. What do you..." And I was a bit shocked. He's like, "What do you think it could be?" I said, "Well, it could be stress related." I said, "Maybe you haven't had enough sleep." I said, "You know, you probably want to go to your GP, your doctor, get a second opinion, maybe the optometrist." All right. I came back an hour later and I went to pay. I got my wallet home, went back to pay. And as soon as I got in the petrol station, the bloke said, "Oh, come and meet the doctor." So now I wasn't just a doctor, I was the doctor. All right. And he says, "Couldn't this be stress related?" I said, "Well, it could be." He's like, "Yeah, our boss, he's a real mongrel, you know." And he was like, they were trying to get me to, I don't know what they wanted me to sign a form or something. I'm like, "Look, get a second opinion from somebody else." But yeah, if you're looking for any medical advice, you're welcome to see Simon or myself later on. Just give us your Medicare card. So thanks, Doc. We appreciate that. Well, that had nothing to do with my talk. All right. When it comes to sleeping and dreaming, I'm not sure what sort of experiences you have. Generally in life, you meet people who can remember their dreams vividly, but for most of us, we forget whatever our dreams are. I'm one of the people, I love dreaming, And so when I'm asleep, sometimes I've been known to be laughing sometimes in my dream or muttering things in my dreams. And often, if you get me at the right time of day, I'll do this sometimes. I'll wake up and I'll tell my wife, you wouldn't believe what I just dreamt. And if I don't say it in the first 2 minutes, it's gone. But sometimes it'll be so vivid that I'll talk to my wife about the dreams. Now, she doesn't seem to have any dreams, or if they do, they all disappear. But apart from having good dreams, and so I've dreamt of all sorts of stuff. I've dreamt of being on the South Pole, you know, with polar bears. I've, you know, climbed mountains. I've had, you know, visions where I've sat down at this all-you-can-eat place that's a fancy restaurant, and they just bring out KFC. Okay, I've just had all these strange dreams. But there's one dream that I had a while ago that I think is probably, I've had it probably more than once, and I think most of us have had this, and it's the dream where you wake up and you're unprepared for something. Now, for me, it's the case of, you know, we all have different careers, but for me, I've had this dream that one day I'll be sitting there in church and there'll be the statement, so right now, Malcolm's going to come up and preach from the scriptures, and I'm thinking, no, it's Pree who's preaching today. I'm not, you know, and I've got this fear that I'm going to be suddenly called up after the Bible reading to give a sermon that I haven't prepared. And it's this feeling that comes over me of just being, oh no, that fear. And so you might have had this before, but sometimes you have that feeling of lack of preparation, or if you've had a dream like that, and it feels terrible. When you're a kid, it's, oh, you know, I'm turning up to class and there's a big exam that day. Or, you know, you have a dream that somehow you've turned up to an event and you're in your undies. You know, there's all these weird, maybe it's just me, okay? But you have these sort of weird dreams of being unprepared. It is the worst feeling ever. And I think in life, we like to be prepared. We like to be prepared for our work presentations. We like to be prepared if we're giving the annual budget. We like to be prepared for an exam. We like to be prepared for hosting people in our homes for a dinner. And preparation gives us an element of confidence as we go about our day-to-day activities. But in life, when it comes to preparation, you know this and I know this. There are some things that demand very good preparation, and there are some things where it's maybe less important. For example, it's important that you prepare well for a career and preparing yourself to work hard. That's more impressive and more needed than preparing a dessert that your guests are going to come over and enjoy. Preparing yourself to get married is more important than preparing to do a task in your workplace. Preparing your end of year tax return, maybe, might be more important than tipping the Canterbury Bankstown Bulldogs this weekend. Okay, there are some things in life that you need to be prepared for. And I think for all of us in this room, it might often be in the back burner, but we do need to be prepared for the day where we stand before the Lord. And he's going to ask us of an account, and as we're going to see in this parable, to whom much is given, much will be required. And the reality is, if you know the Lord Jesus and you're here today, God has given you a certain amount of gold that you might use for him as you live between the first coming and the second coming of Jesus. As I said in the first talk, when we think about the end time, living in light of Jesus' return, the emphasis should not be upon charts, it should not be upon timelines. The emphasis should be, how are you being a steward of the gifts that God has entrusted you uniquely with, so that when you stand before him, he will say, well done, good and faithful servant. So what we're going to do, we're going to continue in Matthew's gospel here, looking at the passage that was just read for us. And what we're going to do, we're going to make our way through a parable, a story that Jesus gave. This again, as I've said, is just before Jesus' death, resurrection, and then ascension. And Jesus, in some ways, is preparing his disciples as he prepares to leave. This is what you need to know in light of my return. Now, we get to the book of Acts after Jesus' return, and they're still asking, is this the time that the kingdom's going to come? They're still a bit slow off the mark. And we're still asking, is this the sign? What should be the sign? What's going to be the sign of your coming? Jesus, as we saw earlier on, said, don't worry about it. You don't need to know the dates, but here's what you need to do. Be wise and faithful. Well, he follows that part of his teaching up with a parable that we're now going to look at. So with that in mind, I'm going to pray, we'll walk through the story, and then we'll think about what faithfulness looks like as we live between the first and the second coming of Jesus. Let me pray. Father, we thank you for your word. As we've said this morning, Lord, our desire is not to be smarter sinners, but transformed saints. And so I pray that you would embed your word of truth by your Holy Spirit into our hearts and minds, so that we might reshape the way that we think about you, the way that we rethink about ourselves and the world we live in, that we might be wise and faithful stewards. And so, Lord, I pray now as we open your word that you would encourage where we need encouragement, that you would convict and challenge where we need those things in our life. But above all of this, that you would lift our eyes to the Lord Jesus Christ, and, Lord, that we would be encouraged as we await his return, for we ask this for his reputation. Amen. Well, Jesus was the master storyteller. There are times when Jesus would announce truth or state truth in a very straightforward way, but more often than not, Jesus would tell stories because in telling the stories, he would use that as a vehicle to communicate truth. I think most of us appreciate that. Now, there are some times when I grew up, stories can be very frustrating. Sometimes you just want to get straight to the point. So when I was at Bible college, we had a class where we had this professor. He had two earned doctorates. He was from Hyderabad, I think, in India originally. And he was a very smart guy. But we would ask a straightforward question, and the answer wasn't always straightforward. So I remember asking, or somebody asked him a question in class, is the exam going to be next Thursday or is it going to be next Friday? And he would respond this way. I know a man in India who owned a snake. And he would then start telling this story, and you would get to the end. And so, and then he'd conclude by saying, so whose snake was it? And you're like, what are you talking about? Is it next Thursday or Friday? Just tell me the answer. Now, other people in different cultures and backgrounds, they like the story because the story can convey truth. Many of us like stories, but sometimes if we don't know the background to the story, we don't always understand the impact. Jesus here is going to tell us a story. He's going to tell us a parable, not necessarily a true parable, but something from everyday life that somebody in his day would have understood and they would have felt the freight of the main point that was being made. And so we begin our story here that Jesus tells in verse 14. Jesus says, again, it will be like a man going on a journey who called his servants and entrusted his wealth to them. Our story revolves around the interaction of this man and his servants. Now, first, the story begins, and this is not unusual, somebody in the ancient world going on a journey, just like today we might go on a journey ourselves. But where he's going, we don't know. Why is he going there? It's not clear. It's also not clear who the man is. This probably, more than likely, is a made-up story that Jesus is telling. But while there's a lot we don't know about the story, and it might be just a story, there are several things that we are meant to pick up from this story by the way that Jesus tells it. First of all, we see that the man here in the story was a man of significance. And we can tell that from a couple of ways. First of all, look at what it says. It says that he had servants. Now, in the end, it's plural there. It's more than one. Now, in Bible times, there were very few people actually who were well off. It's like a lot of the world that we live in today lives off $1 or $2 a day in different contexts. Likewise, in the ancient world, you had a very small proportion of people who had money. But here we get a man who has servants. Most of the people in the ancient world served, or were, we might say, employees. They served somebody else. But here we have a man, and he doesn't just have one person serving. He has servants, plural. This guy is a socially significant person. He is a man of means, we might say. And we know that because he also has great wealth. We're not talking about, you know, the guy could simply buy a decent camel, you know, or maybe he could go out and buy some good wheat or grain, or he had the nicest, he had a little, Airbnb on the Galilee shore. This guy has multiple servants, and he entrusts to them bags of gold. And as we'll see, this is no small thing to have bags of gold. This master's wealthy and he's got great significance. But thirdly, we see he also is a person of authority. That is to say, he has great authority because he calls them to account. He has people, servants, who are employed by him that he gives them from his own means, his wealth, and he entrusts it to them. And then he calls them to his account. Look at the end of verse 14. It said, he called his servants and entrusted his wealth to them. But he calls them, showing his authority, and now he's going to ask them what they have done with his goods. Now he goes on this long journey. Perhaps it was business. Perhaps he was relocating for a season. We don't know. Perhaps he was looking to extend his power. Maybe he was a business guy who wanted to get some new fields or some new places. But whatever the case is, when he returns, he called his servants that he entrusted his wealth to them. Now you'll notice he entrusts his wealth. It's not their wealth, it's his wealth. And he does something, he entrusts it to them. Now I don't have many expensive things at home, but I've got something in my office that is quite valuable. When I say valuable, not necessarily from a money perspective, but it's valuable to me. First time I lived in Israel, I was studying in Israel, and I went to a particular archaeologist, and there was, fittingly, a cracked pot that I bought, kind of symbolic of life, and it talks in the book of Corinthians about being broken vessels. Well, I brought this broken vessel, and it was from Jericho. I know stuff in Jericho is contraband back in Bible times, but they did an excavation of this broken pot, and so it sits there in my office, and it's a reminder not only of my study in Israel, but I've got some sentimental attachment. Now, when I have somebody comes to my office, they're looking around, they might look at the books, they might look at some other things, but then there is my special pot. And if I look at them and I think they're reliable, I'll say, Tom, you can hold my pot. And Tom will hold the pot, and then he'll put it back down. But if somebody comes into my office and I look them up and down and I find out, you know, they're a Parramatta Eels supporter, you know, I'll say, look, yeah, that, you can look at my pot from a distance, right? I don't entrust it to the Toms of the world because I'm a steward. I value something highly. And so here in this story, we've got a boss who's got wealth, great wealth. He's got significant standing. He's in a position of authority. And he says to people, I'm going to give that which is not yours. It belongs to me. I'm going to entrust that to you for this season. That's exactly what he does. Now, the Bible calls this stewardship. This was the idea in the ancient world. A business person, somebody of repute, of significant standing, would entrust their wealth to others. Nowadays, people do that variously. So some people, I've heard, have financial managers, you know, and say, look, this is, I'm not a numbers guy, but I'm entrusting you to be the numbers guy. I want you to invest my money in this for my superannuation or whatever. But that's what stewardship was. It was entrusting to somebody that which was not theirs for your benefit. And so you were giving it to them, you'd want to give it to reliable people. That's what this man does. Let's pick up in verse 15. To one, he gave 5 bags of gold, to another 2 bags, and to another 1 bag, each according to his ability. Then he went on his journey. He entrusts wealth to these 3 servants, and the amount he gives them was significant. First, he gave 5 bags of gold. Now, bags of gold, here, Jesus describes this king who's well-to-do giving away, and I say giving away, it's not for them to keep, but to use. He gives these bags of gold. Now, some of your Bibles might say he gave them talents, and the Greek word talentos just means bag. Okay, and he gives them bags of gold. And just like nowadays, if you go to the Olympics, you've got the gold, the silver, the bronze. They are all worth different amounts. Even the physically, they weigh different amounts and they've got different values. So a gold medal is generally worth the most, followed by a silver, followed by a bronze. And a talent of gold, at least Bible scholars tell us, the heavier your bag, the more significant that was, obviously. And so this guy has five bags. He's got a heavy bag of gold. Now, they say, and this is, again, trusting on Bible scholars here, that they estimate that a talent of gold was probably worth about 20 years' worth of work. So we've got a guy who is entrusted with five talents. Now, I'm not the best at maths, but that tells me that's about 100 years' worth of income entrusted to this guy. Now, remember, this is a story. Whether it happened or not is not the point. I think Jesus is just using it as a vehicle, okay, as a means here. But he's got this guy who gives five bags of talent. That's significant. But the second guy here, he has two bags of gold. That's worth about 40 years' worth of the average person's wage. That's nothing to sneeze at. That's significant responsibility. And then we look at the last guy. He gets one bag. Still 20 years' worth of salary entrusted to this guy. Now, again, it's not designed necessarily to be taken literally as much as Jesus just telling a story. There's a good image that you've got a king who's got considerable wealth and he hands over that which is not the person who he's giving it to, but he gives it to them so that they will steward it. They will do something with the gifts that he gives. The question is, what will they do with the responsibility they given? When the master comes back, how will they respond? We'll look at verse 16. The man who'd received five bags of talent went at once and put his money to work and gained five bags more. So also the one with two bags of gold gained two more, but the one who had received one bag went off, dug a hole in the ground, and hid his master's money. Three servants, all given responsibility, all by the same master. First servant, what does he do? He puts his money to work. We don't know what he did with the gold, but he put it to work. Maybe he went out and he invested in another field. Maybe he went out and he found some great camels and he said, I'm going to buy some camels, or there's a yoke of oxen over there, I'm going to get some oxen. But whatever the case is, he invested wisely, and as a result, he gained five more bags. That is excellent. That's the sort of person you want to be entrusting your stuff to. Second servant, likewise, in response to his master, he goes, he might have invested in fishing. He might have invested in cattle. He might have invested in other things we don't know. But we read, he gained two more bags of gold. This is fantastic. This is the sort of person I want to share my wealth with, because he's going to do something with it. The third servant, in contrast, took the bag and dug a hole in the ground and hid his master's money. And I have to say, when I read that again this week, I thought of the movie The Castle. Remember The Castle? Dale dug a hole. Okay, if you know the reference. But here's the thing, digging a hole and putting your money in it, what is going on there? Well, before Bible times, they didn't really have a great deal of security. So what often people would often do, it wasn't uncommon for somebody to go to dig a hole, especially when no one's looking, nowhere, got to remember where it is, put your treasure in there, cover it up, and you knew it's safe. Nobody saw me. Nobody knows I've dug a hole. Nobody knows where it's hidden. Fantastic. And that's what servant number three does. Doesn't earn any money, but saves it. Let's go to verse 19. After a long time, the master of those servants returned and settled accounts with them. The man who had received five bags of gold brought the other five. Master, he said, you entrusted me with five bags of gold. See, I have gained five more. Here's the thing. The master returns and he settles accounts. It's been a long time that he's gone, but he has returned. And what did he find? Servant number one responded entirely appropriately. This servant had been responsible. He'd cared about the master's reputation. He'd had the master's concerns in heart. He invested, yielded a great amount. And the response of the master is one of absolute pleasure. Verse 21, his master replied, well done, good and faithful servant. You have been faithful with a few things. I will put you in charge of many things. Come and share your master's happiness. This is a great outcome. Person number two. Verse 22, the man with two bags of gold also came. Master, he said, you entrusted me with two bags of gold. See, I have gained two more. His master replied, well done, good and faithful servant. You have been faithful with a few things. I will put you in charge of many things. Come and share your master's happiness. The master here, he's chuffed. He is pleased. The servant has honored him, has honored his reputation, has honored his heart's desires, and a great report is given. Verse 24, then the man who had received one bag of gold came. Master, he said, I knew that you're a hard man, harvesting where you've not sown, gathering what you've not seed, you've not scattered. So I was afraid and went out and hid your gold in the ground. See, here's what belongs to you. This last servant comes and he is unprepared. To use the illustration of earlier on, the doors have slid open, the master returns and he's like, uh-oh. And that's where we find this guy. But you'll notice, again, verse 24 there, he turns it, the blame, not on himself, but where does the blame get it? To the master, to the guy who's been generous, to the guy who said, here, I'm giving you this to use. What does he say? Well, I know that you're a hard man. Harvesting where you've not sown, gathering what you're not. I was afraid. He turns it and he puts it on him. Now, in ancient times, sometimes people would go away for a long time, and just by nature of the ancient world, sometimes people would travel away, and it was before email and Homer Pigeon and all of this sort of stuff, okay? And what they would do, they would go away, but sometimes they would never come back. They get struck down by disease. There might be warfare. They might just find somewhere else and think it's not worth going home. And this guy seems to be, and here's the impression, sometimes people would serve with the hope that, well, the master's not coming. We haven't seen him in ages. That's good news. I'm going to wait a little bit longer. And if he doesn't come, I'm just going to take off. I'll take his money and go. Now, whether this guy was burying it with the hope that the master just doesn't return, the master's gone for a while and he just assumes, well, yeah, we've talked about him coming back, but he's not really coming back. If he was, surely we'd see something. And he bases his inactivity, blames actually, it's because you're a hard man. You're a hard boss and people know you've got a reputation. Listen to how the master responds, verse 26. His master replied, you wicked, lazy servant. So you knew that I harvest where I've not sown, gather where I've not scattered seed. Well then, you should have put your money on deposit with the bankers. So when I returned, I would have received it back with interest. He calls the guy's bluff here. Oh, you're saying I'm a hard man. Now listen, if you really believed I was a hard man, if you really believe that, why didn't you take it to the bank then and put it in the bank and get interest? The guy's, you know, his bluff's been called here. He's come up empty. The servant is called out. He's totally unprepared. He's not been faithful. He's not valued his master. But in some ways, he's ignored the master, maybe just thinking the master's not coming back anyway. The net result of his disobedience can be seen in the conclusion, verses 28 to 30. So take the bag of gold from him and give it to the one who has 10 bags. For whoever has will be given more, and they will have an abundance. Whoever does not have, even what they have will be taken from them. And throw that worthless servant outside into the darkness where there will be weeping and gnashing of teeth. So we hear something like that, and there's probably a few assumptions that we can jump to. What does this mean? Does this mean that if you don't use the gifts that God gives you, you're going to be thrown into hell? And the questions come up from this passage where people say, is this all of Israel now, nationally Israel that he's talking to? Is he talking to individuals here who are in his midst? Is the judgment just something that's a heaven or hell issue? Is it something more? We need to, when we come to a passage like this, remember, just like many parts of the Bible, we need to understand the style that is being given here. And here we have a parable. I don't think we necessarily push literally into there were literal bags of gold. It's not because Jesus is being unfaithful or untrue, but he's simply using a story here, and the story main themes come through pretty easily here. What are we trying to communicate, and what should we glean from this story? The first thing I would even just observe here is that Jesus will come again. The picture here is of Jesus going. It's in the context where they're asking him about signs. What's going to happen with your return? So Jesus tells this story about a master and servants. And clearly we're meant to understand here the master being Jesus himself. And when Jesus is on telling this story, he is on the cusp of leaving. And we would even say leaving for a long time. And he's highlighted that his return is going to be uncertain, just like this story. If they knew, if the guy with one bag knew he's getting back on the 22nd of June on a Thursday night, the guy, I'm sure, would have done either put something in the bank or he would have done something, but he didn't know that unexpectedness. But Jesus tells this story on the cusp of departing, and he will, like the person in the story, he will leave. And then he's going to pick up, and this is going to be a question that, again, we've already raised, who is going to be the wise steward? Who is the wise person who lives between the first coming of Jesus and the second coming of Jesus? What sort of person, what does it look like to be a faithful and wise person that we talked about in our first session? But Jesus here, first of all, indicates he's going to come again. So he's already indicated this. He will leave. But just like the boss comes back, Jesus will come again and he will hold people to account. Jesus will hold people to account. Just as in the first story, he entrusts people with gifts and talents, but he comes back and he expects and he asks them, what have you done with that which I've entrusted to you? There's a level of accountability. Now, in this story, we have people who just ignore the reality that the master will return. They sort of make up in their own mind, oh, he's gone for a long time away, I'll go dig it and put it in the dirt. Jesus here tells a story reminding and giving warning that just as the master goes away and comes back to hold them account, so Jesus is saying he will go away and he will come back and there will be an accounting as well. Well, then it brings us to our question that we sort of raised a little bit in our first session, but how can we live wisely now in preparation for Jesus' return? How can we be the well-done, good and faithful servant in our own context? As I said in the first hour, much of the Christian life is not in moments of drama and significant moments where things happen. Often the Christian life takes place in the eating, drinking, giving of marriage, ordinary everyday affairs of the world. But it's in the ordinary everydays of the world that we still are called to be wise and faithful people. And so we'll look here in this account that Jesus is actually going to give us some instructions on what that looks like. And if you were to ask me, how can we live wisely? It's all about faithfulness. It's about being faithful. Jesus doesn't say, look at verse 21 again. Well done, good and faithful servant. You've been faithful with a few things. I will put you in charge of many things. He doesn't say, well done, good and gifted servant. He doesn't say, well done, good Baptist servant, good Anglican, good even, dare I say it, Presbyterian servant. He doesn't say, well done, good and socially well-known servant. What does he say? Well done, good and faithful servant. In our earlier account, the wise and faithful, here we get good and faithful. God's probably trying to say something to you today, and it starts with the word F, faithful. That's what God is calling you to do. Between the first coming and the second coming, that's what God is calling us to do. Well, how do we do that? What do we see here in this passage that faithfulness looks like? Well, I think as we look to the passage, there's probably a couple of things, but the first thing I want to pause and do is the master says in this passage, or the master in this passage gives those things which the person doesn't naturally have, and he gives them as a gift and a stewardship to them. Sometimes when we hear the word stewardship, we think, and we'll see this plays out as well, we can actually think of literal bags of gold. We can think of literal money, finances, and we'll talk about that in a moment. I think that's a genuine part of faithful everyday living is our use of money. But it's more than that. You know, out of all the people in history, this humbles me a lot, out of all the people in history who have ever lived, to my wife and I, God entrusted 3 children that we raise. Now, they're adults. I don't know. We've tried to be good and faithful, But he gave us children to steward. He gives us jobs to steward. He does give us money to steward. But all of these good gifts, those children, they're not my children. They're God's children. Sometimes we go through life, and this is from a young age, we grow up thinking life is all about what we do and we achieve. You know, the school that you have, the home that you are raised in, the food that nourished you to get you to the point where you've been able to grow physically, that all comes from God's good hands. Yet sometimes we view stewardship very narrowly. I want to tell you today, God has given unique bags to everybody in this room. And he's going to call you to account for that. How are you going with raising children? How are you going raising the Lord's children? How are you going using the Lord's income that he puts into your bank account by giving you a job and giving you physical energy, giving you the mental acumen that you might have? How are you going utilizing his bags of gold? Are you being faithful? A couple of ways that we can do this. What does it look like? Well, first of all, faithful with our time. Faithful with our time. You'll notice in this account, he goes away for a long time, but while he's away, wise guy number one, not saying that in a bad way, but wise guy number one with his bag, five bags, wise guy number two with his two bags, they're using the time wisely. They're not sitting on their hands, they're not thinking, well, you know, it's gone a long time, I won't do anything. The reality is, you don't want to use the time that God has given you and then your time is done. And you've not used it wisely. You want to be prepared. You know, one of the great fears that I have, I've gotten better at this, but one of the fears I used to have is back in the day, again, some of you won't understand this, but I lived in the 1900s where we had physical alarm clocks. You know, they were either the ones that you'd wind up at night, you know, or you had the fancy schmancy electronic ones that had a radio in it, all right? And you put that, but if you got the AM, PM wrong on your alarm, that was always the fear. You got to get up at 6, you know, to catch the bus, and you'd wake up and it'd be 7:12 and you're like, what's going on? And then you look, oh, it was a PM, not an AM, all right? Some of you don't even know the pain that caused many of us. But it was always this fear of, yeah, oh man, I've missed an opportunity. And I'd always, when I travel particularly, I'd always be just on edge. Am I going to make my flight? I've got to make sure I leave on time. And that's always a great fear. Yet many of us live like this. I've been to the airports before where I've got in tow my wife and three kids, and I've done my best. But when you're running and you're stressing from one thing to the next, the big fear is you're not going to make your flight. Sometimes I would say that even as Christians, God stewards us. He's given you a certain amount of years. I just celebrated 54 years around the sun this last week, okay, or 2 weeks ago. I've just turned 54. I might go to 56. I don't know. I might go to 59. I might go to 61. What I don't want to do is think, oh, the master's coming a long time, or I've got plenty of time left in my race. I'll just take it easy. I don't want the master to return or me to go and stand before God at my death and then realize, oh, look, I thought I had more time. I thought you weren't coming for a while. Friends, how are you using your time for the Lord's work? Now, I'm not talking about what are you doing at church. That's important, and that's a real part of life. Sometimes we can narrow down to, yeah, well, we want to make the most of our time, so how many things can you sign up for in church? Okay, and I want to tell you, that's actually helpful for the people of God to be serving. We'll talk about using our talents. But sometimes even at church, we can overcommit to things and be poor with our use of time. You know, Martin Luther, I say this at weddings, but Jesus said, love your neighbor as yourself. To which Martin Luther said, love your wife, she's the closest neighbor you've got. I can do lots of stuff out there, but not be wise stewarding the fact that my wife, or rather my God has given me a wife, and he's given me beautiful children to invest in, to disciple, to lead, and to guide. I can be busy out there, but be a poor steward of time. It could be overcommitting things. It could be sometimes undercommitting, and it's placing too much time on leisure. Now, I've become a bit of a sucker for this, and I'm having to strip things back a little bit. But sometimes, and my kids would cringe that I even tell you this, I got on Instagram, and I'm not big on social media, but I watch these things, reels. And my kids will say, oh, Dad, don't say that. Okay, I watch these things, reels. They are brain-dead, stupid little video clips that go for 20 seconds. And for whatever reason, it picked up my algorithms, and they just put either cricketing, 1988 wrestling with Hulk Hogan, or the mini schnauzers, these mini schnauzers that are doing all sorts of stuff. And I'll sit there for 2 hours. And it's like little dopamine hits that I get. And at the end of the day, look, nothing wrong with leisure. But there's only so many Hulk Hogan videos that are healthy for you. There's only so many schnauzer things that are good. Now, I make light of that, but friends, some of us think that life is about you work your 40 hours so that you can do what you want with the rest of your time, and you do it leisure. Whether that's a fancy holiday, whether that's travel, whether that's just, you know, doing brain-dead stuff. Listen, God wants us to rest. That's biblical. He's built that into us. But sometimes we can take the good gift and make it an idol and actually be burying the treasure or not using the treasure of our time because we're not thinking the master's going to return. We think that it really doesn't matter. Friends, one of the outcomes of our busyness, we often live very busy lives, but we're being unproductive. Be faithful with your time. I don't know what that looks like for you, but I suspect some of us are going to be overcommitters. We don't have time to spend time investing in our wives or our kids or our grandkids or reading a book, even though it's hard and long. But friends, maybe even a result of this sermon, I'm getting no plug here from Torin, but you might want to go buy a book. Why? Because it might be good for your soul, even if you don't like reading, to slow down so that you might spend time with God working out what wisdom looks like in your life. That's a good steward. That's a wise person. Be faithful with your time. Can I encourage you as well? And I think the fact that you're here today would signal to me that you're committed to the Lord and you want to grow in your relationship with the Lord. But can I also encourage you to be faithful with your time in just turning up? Whether that's Bible study, whether it's a gathering at church on Sunday, whether it's meeting up with somebody you said you'd read the Bible with, just be faithful. Use your time wisely. Secondly, be faithful with your talents. I remember when I was at Bible College in Chicago, there's a big time difference between Sydney and Chicago. And I remember one night waking up in the middle of the night and the phone was ringing. And it was one of those ones because I'm a dreamer. I didn't know if it was a dream or not. And so I was sort of in that half awake, half asleep state. And I got up and again, I was readily happy, happily just zoned out. And I got up, but I didn't realize my leg was asleep. I'd fallen asleep. And so I got up to take a step and I went straight down like a bag of potatoes. My leg had fallen asleep, was inactive, and as a result, it didn't work and the body didn't function like it ought. You know, within the body of Christ, we all have different gifts. This is 1 Corinthians 12, Romans 12, Ephesians 4, 1 Peter 4. These passages that speak about gifts, it doesn't, interestingly enough, all reveal the same sort of gifts that we have. In fact, if you look at the four major lists of spiritual gifts in the New Testament, Romans 12, 1 Corinthians 12, Ephesians 4, 1 Peter 4, you won't find identical lists. Why? I don't actually think the list is designed to be exhaustive. I think that God gives us all different gifts. There might even be some gifts that aren't outside of those. You know, God gives some people acumen where they can run a business profitably. They can run leadership groups. And in some people, he gives other gifts. Some are musical gifts. Some people he gives, you know, we read a story like this and say, well, why does one guy only get 2 talents and the other guy get 5 talents? That's all up to the master. All you need to worry about, you don't need to say, well, I only got 2 talents, but that guy over there got 5 talents. Guess what? We are all different. I'm not going to be held accountable for the gifts that you're given. Likewise, you're not going to be accountable for the gifts I'm given. But let me ask you, the talents that God has given you, what unique abilities has God gifted you, whether that's through your education, whether that's through your career path, what has God given to you that you might use for him? Now again, the natural bent would say, Okay, so God gives you to be a good business guy. Here's what he wants you to do with that. Make lots of bags of gold and literally support Christian ministry. All right? Well, yeah, that might be part of it. But sometimes God gives you gifts just to be a godly person and a light to those around you. To treat others in such a way that you reveal what the love of God is like. Friends, we all have different bags of talents here. I'm so glad that I'm not, and you are so glad that I'm not up here leading singing today. I make a joyful noise to the Lord. Okay, but God has not called me necessarily to be a singer up the front. He might not have called you to that. He might not call you to have even a frontline role in church. That's okay. It's all the Master's, and in his wisdom, he has got you where he's got you so that you might use the gifts that he has given you that you don't deserve, by the way, that he gives them out of his grace that you might be faithful with what he's given. Why? Because he's coming back and he wants to see what you've done. And what does he want you to do? He wants you to go through ordinary, everyday life being wise and faithful for that which he's given you. If he's given you a job as a handyman, if he's given you a job to work on a farm, if he's given you a job, you know, to be a chippy, take that as a good gift from God, serving wholeheartedly. Be the best follower and son and child of God that you can be in the areas he's given you with your honesty, with your speech, with your ethic. Disciple your children if he's given you children. Maybe he hasn't given you children. Invest in the life of youth. Invest in the life of a brother here today. Friends, we all have bags of gold. How are you using yours? What is God looking for? He's not looking for the most talented. In fact, if you look at the New Testament, the disciples, he gets a hodgepodge bunch of nitwits. Okay? But God uses those nitwits. Why does God get all the credit? Because it's obvious it's not Peter who's working this. It's not John, it's not James, it's not these duffers, but God is shining his glory through broken vessels. He gives bags of gold still to his people. Your bag might be bigger than somebody else's. Well, just use your bag. Don't focus on what God is doing in the life of somebody else. Just be faithful with what you've got. Don't bury your talents. Be faithful with your time, be faithful with your talents, be faithful with your treasure. Now, one of the things as a pastor, I don't feel this tension. In fact, just the opposite. It is a joy to give. It is a joy to be generous with the Lord's money. But you need to have the mentality that it is the Lord's money. You know, it's one of the great guys in my life. He passed away very tragically. Many years ago, is we went through college together. He was a missionary. And while he was on the mission field, my wife and I were at Bible college, and we were living in America because of our visa status. We couldn't earn too much or do too much work, but we would give a small amount. And it was about $15 or $20 a month to this missionary. We were these US dollars, so that's probably like 1,000 Aussie dollars, okay? But we would give like $15 or $20 a month, you know, to this family. And my friend was on the mission field in Brazil, and it wasn't much, but that's what we could give. I remember he got back, he was on holidays, and he got back, went on holidays, furlough, whatever, there's got fancy Christian names for it, but he was back there talking to supporting churches, and one day I go to my mailbox, and in my bank account, or rather in my student account, somebody just donated several hundred dollars. And then I found out it was these missionaries. I'm like, hang on, we passed it to you. And then they passed it straight back with more. Now, what's going on there? Well, they understood everything that they were living on was the Lord's. And they were just wanting to pass that on. So this is a mistake we make at church. And this is what I must have made a mistake in the past. This is what some of us think. We think, you know what? How much should I give to the church or to Christian ministry? How much should I give to the missionaries who are going to Thailand or the missionaries who are over there or the worker at the university or the TAFE who's telling people about Jesus? Is it 10%? Is it 15%? Is it 20%? Is it before tax? Is it after tax? I get what you're asking. Wrong question. Wrong approach. Here's why it's a wrong approach. It all belongs to the Master. It's 100% His. It's not 90% Malcolm, 10% God's. It's all God's. I don't have a job if he doesn't give me the mind and the skills and the gifting to work here. If I hadn't have gone through this process, that process, without God's leading and directing, I wouldn't do what I do. It's all part of God's grace to us that whatever job you have, whatever station in life, you might be retired, you might be unemployed. Everything God gives you is his. Interestingly, if you are on the dole here in Australia, do you know you're still in the top 10% of the world's wealthiest people? We can sometimes come to a passage and think, oh, well, God hasn't given me much gold. Friends, he's given us comparatively more gold than anyone. What are you doing with the talents that God has given you financially? Because it's easy sometimes for us to say, Malcolm, I'm with you on being faithful with my time, talents, but when it comes to treasure, just leave that one alone. Spurgeon said, the last thing to get converted in a man is his wallet. Friends, sometimes we want to hold on to things, thinking that the gift will make us happy. Friends, there's something better than the gift, and that's the giver. So often in life, we want to hold on to those things that don't, that we think will come. At the end of the day, my wife and I, we bought a house a few years ago through the generosity of God. But you know what? In 50 years, 30 years, I won't own it. Maybe my kids will. But you know what? I can't take that with me. What's going to happen, though, is the doors are going to slide open. The master is going to come, and he's going to say, Malcolm, I gave you talents. I gave you treasure. What did you do with the treasure? And I don't want to say, well, I buried it, or I had a terrific, super account, or I had a property in Zetland, and, it was 114 square meters, and it was great. Friends, I want to use what God has given me. And it doesn't say, you can have a nice car. You can enjoy a nice holiday. This is the grace of God. He is overwhelmingly generous. But just remember, in that generosity, it all comes from his good hand. How are you using your treasure for the Lord? Brothers and sisters, and as individuals, we will be surprised when the Lord either returns or our life is snuffed out. But the question is, when we stand before God, will he say, well done, good and faithful servant, you've used the gifts that I've entrusted you. Well done. Or will he look and say, what have you done? And we say, well, you gave us this. You gave me an opportunity. I lived in this country and I had these friends and family and I had this job. But I know you're a hard man. Friends, be faithful with your time, your talents, and your treasure. We're going to pause right now, and in just a minute, I'll conclude in three or four minutes here. But what I want you to do, if you're brave enough, with the person next to you, one or two people around you, I want you to finish this statement. I want to be more faithful with, and you finish it. Is it a time issue? Is it a talent issue? Is it a treasure issue? And can I encourage you even to be a bit bolder? To not just, I would like to be more faithful with my time, even be a bit more concrete. I want to be faithful with my time by limiting the amount of screen time. I want to be faithful with my treasure by setting up electronic giving to ministry rather than ad hoc throw money in the plate when I got some. Going to give you 3 minutes, person next to you. You don't need to introduce yourself. You've done that already. I want to be more faithful with, you share, and then I'll bring us back together and pray for us in a moment. Take your moment right now and an opportunity, person next to you. Somebody to give thanks for lunch here in a moment. But my encouragement to you with this, hopefully you've seen that when we think about Jesus' return, it's not just about waiting for a sign, reading a paper, looking for certain cues in society. God is interested in how you live faithfully and wisely now, and may that be an encouragement to you. And we're going to look at how that plays out with the frailty and the limits of our lifespan in our last session. Pass back.